Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most noteworthy and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as at Bloomberg.com.
We got a better than expected headline number out of today's jobs report. We got weaker than expected growth in wages. The market initially took this as a positive report, albeit pretty much in line with expectations. But subsequently, President Trump came out and said that the Federal Reserve should drop rates and stop quantitative tightening, even though the economic numbers were very, very good. Joining us now, Joseph Davis, chief economist at Vanguard. We are so glad that you can join us. Before we get into the jobs report itself, what do you think, Joe, of the idea of the Federal Reserve cutting rates right now at this point in the credit cycle?
Well, it's not a view that I would entertain too strongly. I mean, I think if you look at where the Fed funds rate should be, I think it's the Federal Reserve is really navigating a global slowdown and trying to maintain the length of this expansion. And so our view continues to be that the Fed funds rate is close to where it should be. And if there's if you would push me to say where the next move should be, I would say maybe one hike higher rather than cutting rates, because the fundamentals of the economy, we're still accommodative. So long story short, I don't see an urgent need for the Federal Reserve to cut rates.
Joe, was there anything in this jobs report today that changes your outlook fundamentally?
No, if anything, it probably was a little bit of a sigh of relief, to be honest. I mean, we went into the year saying we were going to see growth scares and a market slowdown in the global economy, but we hoped that the labor market would show signs of deceleration, but we wouldn't see material cracks. Now, the disappointing number we saw last month gives one pause in that assessment. So to see the rebound in somewhat volatile data today, I think, was more of a sigh of relief. And I think a vindication that, yes, we will have choppy waters here, but we're not going into recession. I mean, something materially bad would have to happen in the global economy, I think, to take down the U.S. economy at this point.
So here's what I'm struggling with. A lot of people dismiss President Trump's call for the Fed to drop rates and stop QT as being a little outrageous at this point in the cycle. People saying that's not needed. Right now you're seeing solid job growth, et cetera. Bond markets agree with him. Bond markets right now are pricing in more than a 50% chance that the Federal Reserve will cut rates before year end. And it's rising after this jobs report, even though people say that it indicates ongoing strength in the economy. How do you square that?
Well, I think, there are differences of opinion. I mean, it's always, you always have to be a little bit wary saying that the bond market is wrong. It's a very efficient market, but that also doesn't mean the Treasury market's accurate all the time. I think, the financial condition deterioration we saw at the end of last year and in January, a significant fall in risky assets in the equity market, that clearly took some momentum out of the sales of what the Fed, I think, was hoping to do. And so I think we're closer, we're closer to where the Fed's forecast is rather than the bond market. And if we're right that we're not going into recession and the numbers we see today, maybe we'll see somewhat weaker job growth numbers, but nothing below on a trend basis, say below 100,000 jobs per month. If we're right, then what I think could happen is that anticipation of cuts in rates will slowly be priced out of the bond market. I think the key wild card is actually outside the United States, and do we see stabilization in China's growth picture? Because right now we don't have strong evidence of that.
So, Joe, we are now in the 10th year of this economic cycle, which I think is long by most standards. What do you think is different this time, if anything, structurally?
Well, I think the one thing that is different has just been the fact that the recovery's pace has been fairly tepid. So, typical expansions, that haven't involved significant consumer deleveraging, you've had rapid growth out of the recession. The Federal Reserve, not the only factor, but has clearly then been much more aggressive in tightening. I think the low pace of inflation as well as the low pace of economic growth can in large part explain why we're into the 10th year recession, unless things go fundamentally wrong, we could still be talking about the fact that it's an 11th year of expansion this time next year. Now, again, we are not Pollyannish, and the risks are still remain on growth on the downside. But I think it's the tepid pace of growth that explains the duration and magnitude of it.
Just to entertain this idea of a really easy monetary policy or keeping rates low or even going lower at this point, I have to look at the lack of wage growth that we've seen, and that is ongoing despite the fact that headline numbers are beating expectations, even amid an otherwise decelerating U.S. economy. Do you think that that changes the scenario, the backdrop for the Federal Reserve, and means that perhaps past models don't hold true given the fact that they were based on the Phillips curve?
Yeah, well, you know, we've done a lot of work on the Phillips curve. It's a great question. And, you know, it still exists, but you have to control for a lot of factors to see the true relationship. And, you know, wage growth, in our mind, for the past year, we said that wage growth should be around 3% because that's based upon where productivity is. We estimate it at best around 1% in the U.S., and then you overlay an inflation target of around 1.5 to 2%. And so you should be around 3%. Now, you can oscillate clearly above and below that, but we expect wage growth to maybe modestly inch up over the rest of the year, but we would be hard pressed to see 4% wage growth unless we see a material rise in productivity. I think eventually we'll see a rebound there, and when I say higher productivity, that means workers are even more productive than they currently are, and hence they see higher wage increases, and firms reward that productivity. But we're not there yet, and so I actually think wages are where they should be. And a great example of that is to look at places like Japan, where you have record low unemployment rates, yet given their inflation expectations and productivity, wage growth is even below where it is in the U.S.
Joe Davis, thank you very much. Joe Davis is Chief Global Economist for the Vanguard Group, joining us from Malvern, Pennsylvania. And I think it's interesting, Lisa, that you bring up that data on the Bloomberg Terminal about the high percentage, almost 55% probability of a rate cut in 2019, kind of consistent with what we just heard from the president. Yet there certainly are some economists out there, most notably our own Carl Riccadonna and others, that think that given the relative strength of the U.S. economy, that a rate hike is probably more likely. So we'll have to see how that plays out. And obviously, the Fed is data dependent, as we heard from Carl, and they will be looking at future data points coming up to push the agenda forward for the Fed. Well, the Eurozone continues to deal with slowing growth. The uncertainty surrounding Brexit certainly is not helping. And there is ongoing concern in the European banking sector that there may be too much supply of banks in the banking sector in Europe. To help us deal with some of these issues, we welcome our guest, Jean-Yves Fillon. He is the CEO of BNP Paribas USA. He joins us in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio here in New York. Jean-Yves, thank you so much for joining us. I wonder if we could just start off by getting your sense of how the European economy is doing, and maybe specifically dive into the European banking system under pressure. Certainly, I would love to get your thoughts.
Well, thank you for having me, by the way. It's always a pleasure to be here. Well, you said it well. The European economy is showing some slowdown for 2019. The Eurozone is expected to grow GDP growth at best 1%. It's only Europe, by the way. There is a slowdown in Asia, a slowdown in China, and even though the U.S. economy is doing really well, it's not, running in a vacuum, and it's being impacted by what's happening there. Then it's just a factor. You mentioned European banking industry. I think it's important to highlight the fact that since the 2011 crisis and under the leadership of the central bank, the European banking industry has been better, capitalized, is probably more liquid, and has made progress. Having said that, this is an environment the industry has to deal with.
So, Jean-Yves Fillon, the CEO of BNP Paribas in the U.S., I would love your perspective on negative rate policies and the low rate policies that we have on an ongoing basis in the U.S. How much has that been the root cause of a lot of the weakness we've seen in the European banking system?
We should go back to the fundamentals here, because the low rate environment we have today, and maybe to an extreme in Europe with negative rates has been a major contributor to creating stimulus, by the way, in the United States and in Europe at a time it was really needed. In this sense, by the way, we've seen convergence between what the Fed has been doing here and what the ECB is doing there, with a lag time because the status of these two economies, you know, have not been exactly the same.
It's about 18 months. Europe is about 18 months behind the US in recovery.
Very true. And this is what we've seen, you know, the Fed taking measure on stopping QE here and probably the ECB being still in a, you know, stimulus mode, not through QE, but unwinding the balance sheet at a probably, you know, slower pace, and really coming back with, I would say, tools like, you know, the TLTRO, which is a way to inject liquidity directly in the banking system that, you know, might still be required as we probably need to support growth even further. Maybe to the excellent point you made, you know, monetary policy is initially made to support economies, not so much to support the banking system. The banking system, I think, has to adapt to make sure that, you know, whichever the goal for supporting the economy is, we can be there to help and support and help clients. Is a negative rate environment sustainable for the many, many years? Probably not. But I just wanted to highlight the fact that the low rate environment you have here as well, as the Fed is now contemplating basically not hiking anymore and potentially cutting, is something that has actually probably helped industries because of supporting the growth.
What a politically correct answer, Paul, because basically at a time when a lot of people say the negative rate environment's killing banks, a nuanced answer.
He's a corporate banker. He knows how to answer these questions. So Jean-Yves, you know, when we think of BNP Paribas, it's obviously one of the major French banks, a major European bank, but maybe people in the U.S. don't know it as well. Tell us about your business here in the U.S. What is your focus here in the U.S. for BNP Paribas?
We love the U.S. We've been here for quite a long time, you know, decennies. And the platform we have here is actually well-balanced between retail. We own a bank in California, Bank of the West, which makes us part of the fabric of this country in one of the most vibrant states in the United States, California, as big as France, by the way, in terms of size. And the wholesale activity we have out of New York, where we serve large institutional clients, corporate clients domestically in the product suite we have here, which is fairly large. And obviously, our value proposition increases when it's time to serve these corporates, you know, outside of the U.S. and particularly in Europe, where we lead in the Eurobond market. We have 14,000 people in the U.S., 1/4. And this is the largest balance sheet allocation of BNP Paribas Group after France. It's close to 20% of group's revenues. And it is really strategic, and probably more strategic today as this economy still benefit from a strong momentum in terms of expansion.
So I'm wondering, going forward, where you see the best opportunity for profitability in the U.S. Is it in the trading and sales area, particularly, I know, on the debt side? Is it on originating loans? Where are you seeing opportunities?
Well, I think what I've served the practice and the platform in the U.S. is to be very centered around clients. Then my growth and expectations for expansion is around the client base.
What do clients
about it.
Want?
Well, and this is a very good point, because clients, there is an S, right? It's plural. Then if you look at Bank of the West, they have 2.5 million clients. CIB has 2,500 strategic clients. And the more we can continue to support this broad base of clients in a growing economy, serving individuals, entrepreneurs, small cap, mid caps with Bank of the West, and serving large caps with CIB, there is convergence here, and somewhat our white space is inside.
All right. So basically, it sounds like there's going to be a pretty widespread effort to just get clients in. One word answer. Do you think the next move for the Federal Reserve is a rate hike or a rate cut?
Right. There is no one word answer here. That's a good try.
You have 20 seconds.
No, but in 15 seconds, you know, central bankers are evidence-based and react on data, and quite independently and quite well. And I think the Fed and the ECB are going to do exactly the same thing onwards. Look at data and try to continue to support this economy the best way they can to benefit all industries, including the banking industry.
Jean-Yves Fillon, thank you so much for being with us. Chief Executive Officer of BNP Paribas USA and Chairman of the Central Investment Bank, CIB Americas for BNP Paribas, joining us in our Interactive Brokers studio. Today is Jobs Day. It also is a day in which President Trump is discussing Fed policy and ongoing talks with China. So very much the Washington, D.C. front in focus today. Chris Liu joining us now, senior fellow at the University of Virginia Miller Center, also former Deputy Secretary of Labor under President Obama. Chris, thank you so much for being with us. We want to get to a piece that you wrote for Newsday that is really interesting. Before we get there, do you have an initial read on today's jobs report and the idea that the Fed should cut rates, as President Trump said, going forward?
You know what? A couple months ago, we were talking about the Fed raising rates, and now we're talking about the Fed cutting rates. You know, look, I don't. We always say don't read too much into one month. I think last month, you know, was a blip down. I want to see a couple more months of job growth. We've seen over the first 3 months of this year, the economy is averaging about 180,000. That's pretty good. It's kind of right where we ought to be. So I would, if I were advising the Fed, I would just tell them to keep things where they are, see a couple more months before we make decisions on interest rate hikes or cuts.
Chris, I know a couple days ago you wrote an opinion piece in Newsday talking about security clearances, why they matter, and just security protocols overall, why they matter in the White House, any White House. How is the Trump White House different in terms of traditional security clearances and protocols?
Yeah, so let me give you a little bit of context. Before I was the Deputy Secretary of Labor, I managed President Obama's cabinet. Before that, I managed his presidential transition. So I've seen the security clearance both coming into office in 2009 and then processing all of the people who served in the White House. This is a process that's handled by career professionals who work in the White House and the different intelligence agencies. It's exhaustive. I was clear three different times when I worked for Barack Obama. It's not only, you know, exhaustive information about your job history and financial information, foreign contacts, drug use, alcohol use. They go out and talk to your associates, friends, colleagues, neighbors, and they gather a lot of information, and career professionals make these decisions. And the reason they spend so much time on this is that when you're cleared for, you know, top secret access to information, you have access to some of the most sensitive information in the U.S. government. These are this is information that's been gathered at great financial cost and often at a cost to the people that collect it. So you want to make sure it gets in the hands of people who deserve it. So earlier this week, there was a whistleblower who indicated that at least 25 cases in the White House, career officials denied the security clearances for White House officials, and then those were overruled by the political folks above them. And so, you know, look, this is it's sometimes hard to keep track of what really matters in Washington. This should really matter, and this should matter regardless of what party you're a member of.
Why? What are the potential consequences?
Well, look, part of the reason why this process is so exhaustive is you want to make sure people don't have vulnerabilities, they don't have weaknesses, because foreign governments, foreign adversaries are looking to exploit those weaknesses to get access to this information. And if you've got something in your past, personal issues, financial issues, if you've got a set of foreign contacts, that makes it easier to manipulate you. And so, again, as I said, this information comes at great cost to the U.S. government, and we want to make sure it gets into the hands only of those people who can be trusted.
So, Chris, I know this this report that came out, it cited, quote, two senior White House officials. I guess they were presumed to be Trump's daughter, Ivanka Trump, and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, got their clearances only after the intervention of President Trump. How common is that type of arrangement?
Well, it's incredibly unusual. I mean, I look, I'm not aware of a single instance where a security clearance denial was overturned during the Obama administration. I know that subsequent reporting has indicated there may have been one or two and it dealt with, you know, an initial denial based on drug use that was then overturned. But these are overturned, like, at a very low level, you know. And, you know, different administrations sort of look at particularly drug use in sort of different ways. I am not aware, and I don't think I've seen any reporting indicating that a previous president has overturned one of these rulings. And obviously doing it for your family member raises a whole other set of issues. And so, yes, it should be concerning. What's interesting, though, with regard to Jared Kushner is that while his top secret clearance denial was overturned, he now has top secret clearance. There's an additional level of clearance that the CIA offers. It's called SCI clearance. Apparently, they have not given him that clearance. So one of the parts of his portfolio is to negotiate Middle East peace, and he's doing that with access to some information, which is sensitive, but not to all of the information. So that's a little odd.
We're speaking with Chris Liu, senior fellow at the University of Virginia Miller Center. He also has a 20-year career in public service in the highest echelons of the Obama administration. And before that, 8 years working for Representative Henry Waxman as deputy chief counsel. I'm just wondering, given your extensive experience and your extensive roots in Washington, D.C., how many old timers are there left? In other words, given some of the institutional knowledge that is built up over time, how much of that remains in Washington today?
Well, not much of it. And I think it's the challenge in a social media environment to sort of try to put to context what is happening and what matters and what doesn't matter. You know, I mean, if you think about just sort of the news of this past week, one of the other big news items is that House Democrats requested President Trump's tax returns. Well, it's worth noting for history purposes that presidents going back to Richard Nixon have either disclosed their tax returns when they were running for office or shortly after becoming president. And so, yes, I know in the kind of the swirl of social media, we love to say everything is unprecedented, but sometimes you have to look in the lens of history and say, okay, really, where are the norms? And where is this president's actions, conduct, words outside of that norms? And so it's sometimes hard because, as you say, there aren't a lot of people now in Washington who have that historical knowledge.
Well, Chris, the House Oversight Committee is looking at the security clearance issue. What's the end game here for them? Can they affect any change, revoke anything? Do they have any power?
Well, look, they've issued subpoenas to the supervisor who was in charge of overturning a lot of these denials. They've also asked for copies of memos on the subject. According to news reporting, former Chief of Staff John Kelly put in writing his concerns about Jared Kushner getting a clearance. So it'll be interesting to see where they get all that. So there will be a fight back and forth about whether these witnesses testify, about whether those documents are turned over. Ultimately, Congress can legislate on this issue. I mean, it is true that the president has the authority to grant a clearance to whoever he wants, but I suspect Congress will try to put greater checks into that and at the very least require some kind of notification to Congress before that happens.
Chris Liu, thank you so much. Chris Liu is a senior fellow at the University of Virginia Miller Center, and he's also a former deputy secretary of labor under President Obama.
Well, there are a bunch of IPOs lined up, the initial public offerings that we've seen so far. We've seen Lyft, we've seen Tradeweb. They've generally been pretty well received, although Lyft has been a little bit rockier. But Blue Apron might be sending a very interesting and perhaps inauspicious message to the IPOs that are lined up for later this year. Sarah Ponczak, cross-asset reporter for Bloomberg News, joins us now to discuss why that may be. So, discuss what happened with Blue Apron.
So Blue Apron can be a cautionary tale. If you look at Blue Apron since its IPO, I mean, this is a stock that trades at a dollar. It's down 90%. And when you consider the fact that they originally were talking about pricing at a much higher level, and the only reason they didn't was because that was right around the time that Whole Foods and Amazon were talking about teaming up, then it would be about a 95% drop for Blue Apron. And it has not been that long. It's only been since 2017. So the way you can look at this is that Blue Apron, interestingly enough, yes, it is a meal kit service. It's a food delivery service, but it's also very much grouped in with potential high growth companies, also with tech companies, because it's supposed supposed to be disruptive. It's supposed to be a disruptor. And that's along the lines of a lot of the companies that we are seeing come to market this year, potentially. I mean, take Lyft, for example. No, Lyft has nothing to do with food, but they are a ride-sharing service, and that's supposed to be disruptive to the auto industry, potentially. Same thing with Uber, and then you think of other companies like maybe Pinterest, Slack coming out later this year. They all are very niche in a way. So some are saying you can look at Blue Apron, and yes, you have to say it is clearly a very different type of company, but look at the rough year and a half about that it's had, and what does that mean for all of the unicorns that we have heard are going to go public this year?
Yeah, I think what it clearly says is if you don't, just in case of Blue Apron, if you don't deliver on what you say you're going to do in your IPO roadshow, this market will absolutely pound the stock. And I think for Lyft, just, you know, Lisa mentioned Lyft in the intro, it is, we have to note, it's back above the $72 IPO price. It's $75 right, and change here today. So maybe it's, maybe this one's found a little bit of a footing. But what I did hear in the aftermath of the Lyft, and I'd be interested to get your sense, Sarah, is for Lyft, for example, you know, here's a company that lost $1 billion last year. Mm-hmm. It's really unclear about when they're going to actually achieve profitability. So yes, I get the top line's growing, but I don't have a real path or a real good sense of a path to profitability. That could be a problem, I think, for not only Lyft that we've seen, but maybe some of these other companies.
Well, that's the common denominator here. Blue Apron has never had a quarter of profits. Lyft has not either. Uber hasn't either. So these companies, they have to believe that investors are going to take a bet that no, they're not turning profits right now, but they will eventually be profitable and it's going to be worth it. But a lot of investors are starting to realize that maybe it's going to take a little bit longer for these companies to actually grow into their profits, actually turn profits, than they believed at the start of it. And that's why a lot.
Wait. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Is there any evidence of that, of investors actually showing skepticism here?
So some that I've spoken with, I mean, the issue is they're having a hard time with valuations. I mean, a lot of people are looking at these companies and saying, I honestly don't know what to value Lyft at. Yes, we're trading back above the IPO price, but it's difficult because you can promise on your roadshow, you can promise when you IPO that you're eventually going to be profitable, but there's a little skepticism.
So there's skepticism, but they're still buying at the very high valuations and they're still sending stocks higher. So even with this lack of conviction around the company's outlook, they're still actively pushing up prices.
They are, but we also have to remember we're only a week into Lyft's trading. UBS,
we need to make lots of broad assumptions about the broad entire IPO market about this.
Oh yes. No, it's only been a week, so it's hard to take away exactly what's going to happen. But UBS, interestingly enough, they put out a report this week that kind of dived into the typical on average trading reactions of IPOs, and they found that the first day, the first week, you typically have really good play because people are excited still. People are still really pumped up about this new company that has so much hype around it coming to market. Where you start to see it really start to potentially lose traction is in the 6 month mark out to 3 years, because on average, typically an IPO is actually lower. The market return, the risk adjusted return over that period is lower than the market because people start to become a little bit more skeptical. The excitement fades away. So it's hard to really take this all away from Lyft, for example, right now. It's too soon to tell. We're going to have to see what actually happens. And with the other unicorns mm-hmm. that are supposed to come out this year too, because they are names that have so much push and so much support and hype surrounding them that it's also kind of hard to live up to that.
Right. We'll have to see. Sarah Poncik, thank you so much. Sarah's a cross-asset reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us live here in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney.
I'm Lisa Abramowitz. I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.